You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, there have been claims that private property rights on Native American reservations will help alleviate poverty. Our guest tells us why she thinks that's not the most effective policy.
Right now, we've made it past the first presidential debate, and the candidates are hitting the campaign trail to make their case in key battleground states.
Also, a new report shows shifting religious affiliations in the electorate, and that may affect voter preferences in coming elections. And a prominent newspaper broke with convention in their presidential endorsement.
Joining us now to talk about the latest from the campaign trail is Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Well, what was your main takeaway from the debate earlier this week?
Honestly, my main takeaway from the debate is that Donald Trump can still be riled. He takes this stuff personally. It was really interesting to hear him say basically that Hillary Clinton was running a bunch of negative ads against him, and that's not nice, and he doesn't deserve it. It was just an odd revelation that his feelings get hurt, which from a guy who is known to be kind of a bare-knuckle brawler, I mean, this is his style, is to be aggressive and you know, lying Ted and cheating Hillary. It's just really interesting to hear him say, hey, you hurt my feelings. It really struck me that he could basically take offense.
In terms of the points made by both Trump and Clinton that were made during the course of the debate, which ones do you think are going to prove the stickiest, that are going to stay with those candidates for better or worse for the next few news cycles?
Yeah, well, it depends. I mean, the sad part is I think that, on a policy basis, Donald Trump's best moment sort of got lost in this whole thing. I mean, Trump managed to corner Hillary Clinton on trade and gave her with no really good answer. She provided no really good answer on where do you stand on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I don't think he handled it properly, but he really had her sort of against the ropes there and saying, well, okay, is it Obama's fault that the agreement's no good? But that issue got lost under all of this stuff about, you know, is Miss Universe actually Miss Piggy? And that stuff is just unfortunately takes over. I mean, I think ultimately the real takeaway from the debate is that Donald Trump didn't have 90 minutes worth of material at his fingertips. He had 20 minutes or half an hour worth of material at his fingertips, and then he got stuck. And when you sort of let him get off on this kind of ad-libbing, he doesn't really have a lot of material prepared, or didn't have a lot of material prepared. And I think that cost him. He didn't manage to bring up things that were bad for Hillary Clinton, like her foundation or like her emails, and really press her on it. He didn't have the facts on his fingers.
The polls had been getting closer and closer. Hillary Clinton's lead had been slipping leading up to this debate. We're still just 2 days out. Not a whole ton of polling can happen in that time. Are you seeing any early indications, or what are you watching for to see if this debate actually made a difference among voters?
I'm actually going to ignore everything for another day or two. I believe that sort of the voter population at large has a consciousness that moves, but it takes a few days to bake in. So I suspect by the end of this week we'll have some first polls coming out of the debates. I mean, the conversation has been generally favorable to Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump has been on the defensive about his performance. So that would indicate that even he and his campaign sense that it wasn't his best night. But then again, I also am not convinced there's a whole lot of undecided voters to sway here. I think we're really at the point where the question is, are you driving your people to the polls?
And given what we saw on Monday night, Paul, what are you expecting to see, if any, change in approach when it comes to either candidate for the next two debates coming up?
Well, I think that, you know, my impression is that Trump and his staff are going to try and basically practice a little more material, practice a little more. And this is a politician thing. If you've ever spent any time around politicians, you'll notice they have this incredible skill of answering the question they wanted you to ask, not the question you actually asked, and changing the conversation to the topic they want to discuss. And it's something that it takes practice to do because it's not natural. Most of us, if you ask a question, you get an answer that's related to the question. What Donald Trump has not been able to yet master is the art of changing the topic, changing the premise of the conversation to a subject that he'd rather talk about. And I think it's something they're probably going to practice. How do you pivot from, you know, what Hillary Clinton did? When they said, how about your emails? She said, oh, yeah, well, how about his tax returns? right? I mean, that's the thing that a politician learns to do, and I suspect he'll practice some of that.
Before we move on from the debate, Paul, there's a lot of people watch this thing, 80 million plus, then people who listen to it as well. A lot of times, I think a big event like this, a lot of people just get it the next day in clips and sound bites and newspaper analysis. This was unmediated in a way. People watch this thing directly. Does that matter?
I don't know. I mean, again, it's a question of how much. I mean, yeah, it does, because people see the initial reaction to how they watch these people interact. The problem is, what I don't know, Rob, is how many people sit there and watch an hour and a half of it. You know, do you tune out? Are you really watching the debate, or are you watching the Twitter reaction to the debate? Are you watching the what your friends email you about the debate? I just don't know the answer to that question. It's been a long time since I was an uninterested observer sitting in my house with a bowl of popcorn and a beer, which is how I used to watch the debates. And I don't really know if people do that anymore. I think there are so many distractions and so many second screen experiences that part of it is you're sort of absorbing the commentary as well as the live stream simultaneously.
We're talking with Paul Singer from USA Today, talking about the latest in national politics. And, Paul, you wrote a piece recently about the increasing number of people who self-identify as being unaffiliated. They're often called the nuns when it comes to their religion. And that seems to be a break from previous generations. How might this shake out at the polls?
It's very hard to tell. They're a really interesting group, and these studies have all been going the same way, that basically the number of people who will tell you they are affiliated with a certain religion is dropping dramatically, and really dropping dramatically amongst millennials. I believe the number was like 39% of millennials said they are not affiliated with any particular religion. And when I say that, I mean a pollster gets them on the phone and says, well, you know, are you Christian? Are you Jewish? Are you Catholic? Are you Protestant? Are you Muslim? Are you Hindu? And the person has to answer, no, I'm none of those things. So it's not only saying, do you go to church regularly or anything else? It's saying, no, I'm not actually, I don't consider myself a member of a faith group. 39% of the millennial generation, that's a huge number of people and a significant, could be a significant voting block. The problem the reason that they're not necessarily decisive in the elections, they don't vote very often. Some of the numbers we saw is that while evangelicals are about, you know, maybe the same number of the population, about 20% of the voting population, they end up being 26% of the vote because they actually show up in droves, whereas these millennials end up being, maybe 12, 13% of the vote. So if you could ever engage them in a conversation that drives them to the polls, that could be a very powerful force. But here's the question. Where do you find them? Since they're not religiously affiliated, they're not the same place on Sundays where you can go get them. So it's a really interesting question, and I think something that will be very interesting to watch as they grow older. They're more likely to engage in voting behavior, regular voting behavior, and then suddenly you can ask the question, what if our voting population becomes predominantly non-religious? Would that change how we vote? Very interesting.
And how would it change how, say, a political party or a candidate tries to reach voters? I imagine they're probably going to wrestle with this issue in the years to come.
I think they will, and the study that I was looking at suggested that a lot of these people have left the church because of basically they find the church, or they have left various churches, not just the church, you know, pick a church. They've left faith communities because, in part, they felt the faith communities were too conservative on a bunch of issues, most notably climate change and gay marriage. So in theory, those would be Democratic issues. These might be Democratic voters in the future, but I think it's a great question of how do the politicians reach that community that is not at the moment actively voting, and what do you connect them to? If you say, I mean, you're not going to say to them, well, you know, I care about the same faith issues you care about. No. You have to get to them with, I care about the same social issues that you care about that motivate you. So where do you find those people, how you engage them, I think is a really interesting question for, you know, the election of 2020 or the election of 2024.
So you don't expect it to come into play in this election?
I don't expect it to come into play in this election, again, because I don't think, two reasons. One is I don't think that this group is going to be a big enough voting block again to really make the difference. They were very enthusiastic about Barack Obama. They are not, I don't think, as enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton. We've seen that over and over again. And second of all, this election has been less about issues like that. I mean, once upon a time, there were a lot of state based initiatives to like ban gay marriage or limit abortion that would drive both sides to the polls. You don't see a lot of those on the ballots around the country this year. Those are not the issues that are driving people to the polls. I do think that Jill Stein and the Green Party, and to some degree Hillary Clinton, are trying to capture climate change to drive people to the polls. But I honestly just don't know yet whether it's reaching these voters.
Paul, a one-question lightning round. Another newspaper that traditionally endorses Republicans going back a long time now, the Arizona Republic, and now has endorsed Hillary Clinton. Does that matter? What do you make of that briefly?
I never think that the newspaper endorsements matter. What it does matter is it offers cover in this election for sort of centrist or traditional Republicans who want an excuse to not vote for Donald Trump and possibly vote for Hillary Clinton. These kind of endorsements from traditional Republican outlets give them the cover they need to say, I'm not selling out my party when I don't vote for Donald Trump.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. You be well.
You too. That's Paul Singer. He joined us to talk about the latest in national politics. Paul is the Washington correspondent for USA Today.
Coming up after the news, a guest tells us why she believes private land ownership isn't the solution for socioeconomic challenges facing Native American reservations. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.